Welcome to the Inside Elections podcast, where we analyze elections in a nonpartisan, data-driven, and accessible way. In this episode, we'll analyze the results from Tuesday's primary runoff in Texas, where an incumbent teetered on the brink of defeat, and we'll look ahead to Senate and House primaries and general elections in Nevada, where critical fights for the majority and White House are taking place. And we'll do it with help from guest Gabby Berenbaum of the Nevada Independent. Buckle up. I'm Nathan Gonzalez, editor and publisher of Inside Elections, the go-to place for nonpartisan analysis for 40 years. And I spent Memorial Day weekend at our pool just across the Northeast DC border in Maryland's 4th District, represented by Democrat Glenn Ivey.
And I'm Jacob Rubashkin, deputy editor of Inside Elections, and I spent some of Memorial Day weekend in Virginia's 6th District in the Shenandoah Mountains, which is represented by Republican Ben Klein.
Jacob, what happened this week in Texas?
So we had a nail biter of a Republican primary runoff in Texas's 23rd district. This is a sprawling West Texas district that kind of begins just outside of El Paso in West Texas and goes all the way down the Rio Grande. It's one of the largest districts by geography, I believe, in the country, certainly a non-at-large district. It's represented by Republican Tony Gonzalez. Now, Gonzalez had taken a few votes that had really angered some conservatives and grassroots activists in his district over his 3 or so years in Congress. He faced a challenge in this runoff from Brandon Herrera, who is a YouTuber and a gun manufacturer. And Herrera, while he did have kind of a long history of controversial and offensive jokes and comments about veterans and other groups of people, and had only really moved from North Carolina relatively recently, he was clearly a threat to Gonzalez because of the anger against the incumbent. And the congressman's allies spent nearly $3 million bucking him up in the primary and attacking Herrera. Ultimately, it seems like that was money that was quite well spent because Tony Gonzalez won his runoff by 387 votes.
Ooh. Yikes. And like you said, that money was well spent from the Gonzalez allies because without that, it seems like he would have lost. And that would have changed the complexion of Congress a little bit, right? I mean, to go from Tony Gonzalez to someone more provocative like Herrera could have made a real difference.
Yeah, and there was an outside possibility that if Herrera were the nominee, this would have become a competitive general election district. It leans toward Republicans, but with a guy like Herrera who was so controversial, I think it absolutely could have been an opportunity for Democrats had he been the nominee.
Now, there was also a runoff in the Republican race to take on Henry Cuellar. I don't know that we've mentioned that Democratic Congressman Henry Cuellar of Texas was indicted on bribery charges. And that district, we had not rated it as we had taken it off our list of competitive races. Now we've added it back on. But now at least Republicans have a challenge. But what are the prospects for Republicans in that race here initially?
Slim, but it doesn't help Cuellar that he is under indictment, that there have been kind of damaging stories coming out about his family and kind of potential allegations of corruption there. This is a district that it still leans Democratic, but has been zooming toward Republicans over the last couple of election cycles. Cuellar performed better than any other Democrat here in 2022. He's clearly got an appeal. But if he's convicted of these charges, there's going to be tremendous pressure for him to resign. And if he's not, if he doesn't resign, there's going to be a movement to expel him, I'm sure, if he's convicted. And I think Democrats would be hard pressed to win this district in a special election anytime soon.
And sticking with Texas, there was another consequential runoff. State Rep Craig Goldman won the GOP runoff in the Fort Worth area in the 12th district. This is the race to replace longtime Republican Kay Granger. He's the 20th House candidate we've added to our likely new members list. This is a list we've been publishing in the newsletter. These are candidates who won primaries in either solid or likely takeover districts. And so where the general election is more of a formality because it's either solid Democratic or solid Republican. But Goldman will come to Congress next year with the reputation of being a serious lawmaker. I would encourage you to check out episode 17 of the podcast where we had Fort Worth native Abby Livingston talking about this race and others, but she talked about Goldman and more of his background. But yet another example of that primaries matter, including electing a member of Congress. But let's move on. Let's move on to our big segment. I want to welcome our special guest, Gabby Berenbaum, the DC correspondent for the Nevada Independent. Gabby previously worked at the Washington Monthly. Her work has also appeared in the Richmond Times-Dispatch and The Hill. Gabby, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Well, before we get into talking about Nevada, what congressional district did you grow up in?
I am from one of the boringest congressional districts, I think, in the country, which is VA 08, which is Arlington, Virginia, where I'm from, in Alexandria. It's a D plus 55 in the last presidential election, so not the most competitive elections, as you can imagine. But what we lack in competitiveness, we make up for in the fact that I think we're probably the district most affected by government shutdowns. So good little Congress angle for us there.
And for those people that aren't in the D.C. area, this is just across the river from D.C. So it is very close. And did you grow up in a political family, or how engaged were you politically growing up?
I think, and Jacob, you're from the other side of the river, right? You're from Montgomery County.
Yes.
So I feel like, you know, just being from the area, I feel like everybody's always talking about politics in one way or another, whether it's a lot of people work for the federal government. A lot of people just get involved in elections. I remember, like, my parents, when I was 9 years old, my parents had a party for like a presidential inauguration and had people over and just to watch it on TV. So I think pretty standard experience. Yeah.
That's a classic DC area experience that I think we all shared.
Yeah.
And growing up, how did you pronounce Nevada? And did you know that it was such a polarizing subject?
When I was interviewing for my current job, that was the first thing I looked up, and I watched multiple YouTube videos to make sure that I was, it's Nevada, not Nevada. They get very upset if you get it wrong, including sometimes in congressional hearings, the senators will get really mad if a witness that they already don't like mispronounces it, they'll snap at them. So
that's good. And I guess he's your boss, right? John Ralston, very, very particular, you know, he will call people out as well. So,
oh yeah. Yeah. If you offend the We Matter state, as he likes to call it, you'll hear from him. So
yeah. I like how every kind of jurisdiction has like a name, I guess in this case it's the name of the state, but like that if you're not from there, you don't know, you're gonna mispronounce it. And it's a very easy way of like figuring out, like in Maryland it was always Bowie, right? Like
yeah,
people
yeah.
look at Bowie and they say Bowie if they Ooh. Don't know.
In Virginia, like, it's Norfolk.
Like the yeah. David. Yeah.
Yeah, it's true. Every state has their thing that shows if you're an insider or an outsider, which is funny about Nevada because a lot of people are not from there who end up there. So, but that's, I guess, the first thing you learn.
Well, they hand you the packet.
Yeah.
When you cross the border. Yeah.
Yeah.
And being from Oregon, it's usually the Willamette Valley. Like you get all sorts of Willamette. It's just sort of a disaster. So, all right. Well, let's dive right in. So So there's a lot going on in Nevada. Democratic Senator Jackie Rosen is up for re-election, and she has to win in November to give Democrats any chance of maintaining control of the Senate. But there's a Republican primary first, and that is on June 11th. Let's listen to a couple of ads from candidates Sam Brown and Jeff Gunter.
Biden and Democrats' open border is flooding our communities with drugs and crime. Their reckless policies have led to skyrocketing prices and Nevada having one of the highest unemployment rates in the country.
As a veteran, I'll never compromise America's security. I'll finish Trump's wall and stop the invasion at the border. As a small business owner, I'll lower prices and make Trump's tax cuts permanent. I'm Sam Brown, and I approve this message.
I'm Jeff Gunter, and this is my office. For 25 years, I've treated skin cancer patients and have seen the damage radiation can do. But Sam Brown doesn't seem to care and plans on dumping toxic nuclear waste here just miles away from children's schools. He's already sold out to Mitch McConnell, but I'll fight back to block the Yucca Mountain nuclear waste plant so it never comes to Nevada. I'm Jeff Gunter, and I approve this message because I think we need a senator who protects families, not politicians.
So, Gabby, we know that Brown is the preferred candidate of strategists here in D.C., but how serious is this primary?
I think, look, it's interesting in that it's, I think, the only competitive Senate race where Trump hasn't endorsed. But I feel like that has more to do with him having ties to multiple candidates than how competitive the primary is. In Brown's internal polling, so take it with a grain of salt, we've seen Gunter go up from something like 1% to, I think, 14% in the most recent one. But you still have Brown up like 35 points. So I think the Brown campaign and the Rosen campaign, because they've already started airing negative ads about Brown, certainly believes Brown's going to be the nominee. And I think even though he hasn't endorsed, Trump does too. He's posted a few graphics with him and Brown on it. He's talked about how he's seen Brown up in the polling. So I think, well, it's been an interesting primary, and given that it's Nevada, there's always some sort of interesting, wacky candidates, and Gunter maybe is one of them. I'm thinking Brown's going to be the nominee.
Yeah, well, and Jacob, I want your take as well. What stood out to me about those two ads, and those are just two of the ads, but you had, you know, Brown focusing on immigration and kind of typical Republican rhetoric, but Gunter's ad was focusing on Brown a little, right? And so I don't, maybe Brown just doesn't think that Gunter is serious enough to sort of feel the need to go negative yet. But that also always kind of gives me a little bit of pause when one candidate's going negative against the other and the other isn't sort of responding. But Jacob, what's your, how do you feel about this primary?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I agree with Gabby that it seems like Brown is going to be the nominee, but I do think it's been interesting that like Brown has gone from not even really acknowledging that he has a primary at all to like, oh, there's a recognition now among his people and even in their own polling that Gunter is a factor in the race, even if, you know, he's still not in kind of a threatening position. He's not in contention to win in their numbers. At least they're referring to him. They're acknowledging that he exists and not that Sam Brown is just already in this general election against Jackie Rosen. But the other interesting thing, and Gabby, I'd be interested in your take on this, is kind of how the a name we haven't mentioned, Jim Marchant, went from being kind of the most prominent guy in this race, maybe at the beginning, to an also ran. I mean, he was the nominee for Secretary of State last time. He was the nominee for Congress two cycles ago. He was in the state legislature, has a cult following, as it were, and yet he really just seems like a non-factor in this Senate primary.
Yeah, I think he kind of lost the juice, is how I would put it. His main thing he's known for in Nevada is being this really prominent election denier who in 22 ran for Secretary of State as part of that coalition of Trump-aligned Secretary of State candidates. And I think as that issue has lost salience among Republican voters especially, he's just been less appealing, one. And two, if you watch his performance at some of these like debates, if you see what his campaign is spending on, he's not really out there. I mean, he's like spending his time at Mar-a-Lago, getting a few donations, and at multiple Senate debates now, he's like hawked his own currency. So I just think this is not someone who is running with like the level of seriousness that he, I guess, had before enough to win primaries.
Wait, I got to rewind a second here. What is his own currency? Like his own money? What is that?
Yeah, I don't know if totally you knew. Yeah, the deep state is going to get rid of the dollar in short order here. So you're going to want, I forget what it's called. It's like Marchant bucks or something. But you're going to want to grab onto
not
that.
Not even gold. It's something different. It's his own. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
And before we talk about the general election, because that is extremely important, what is the latest about the Trump endorsement? I think I saw this morning, we're taping on Wednesday, recording on Wednesday morning here, that Trump is going to be in Nevada the weekend before the primary.
Yeah, he's going for a fundraiser.
So is there any sort of indication on an endorsement and what he might do? Any feeling in that way?
Last week, he said you're going to see an endorsement in the next few days, and that didn't happen. But I wouldn't be surprised if he does right before the election, once he feels confident that Brown is going to win.
Yeah, I guess Trump does have a couple other things going on, at least one other thing going on.
I can think of one,
right,
yeah.
Now. Well, let's shift to the general election. Like I said before, this is a must-win general election for Democrats because they're going to lose the West Virginia seat. And if Trump wins the White House, then Republicans get control of the Senate. But if Biden wins, then Republicans need a second seat on top of West Virginia. And Nevada is one of the top targets. Ohio and Montana are in a class of their own, but then Nevada is part of this second tier. Let's listen to a couple different ads from Senator Rosen.
We have to do something about the cost of housing.
They jack it up, yep, every time. Makes me feel like I'm not going to be able to buy a house one day.
It's why I secured funding for more affordable housing options in Nevada. And I'm going after corporations that buy up properties and drive up the cost.
Jackie Rosen fighting price gouging by corporate investors who buy up housing stock to drive up mortgage and rent costs.
I'm Jackie Rosen, and I approve this message because Nevada housing should be affordable for Nevada families. I'm Jackie Rosen, and I approve this message.
How extreme is MAGA extremist Sam Brown? He said abortion should be banned without any exceptions for rape or incest. He said it's non-negotiable. He pushed to overturn Roe v. Wade and said he'd only vote for anti-abortion Supreme Court justices. He even supported the Texas ban, one of the harshest in the country. Sam Brown, another MAGA extremist trying to take away abortion rights.
So, Gabby, as this race heats up, what are you watching?
Yeah, I think it's going to come down to what each campaign wants people to be talking about by November. If you're Rosen, you want people to be talking about abortion. You want people to be talking about how Brown is, like you said, you know, a MAGA extremist, Trump aligned, everything like that. But I think also the fact that she's running already talking about cost of living stuff, I think is an acknowledgement that that's something that Democrats are going to have to engage on. And that was something that Senator Cortez Masto did in the 22 cycle. She was considered the most endangered senator then, a Democratic senator, and hung on to her seat. And it was a race where the margin was less than a point. So, you know, you could point to a million reasons as to why she won. But her campaign sort of believes that leaning in on inflation, talking about high cost of gas, groceries, et cetera, and sort of shifting the narrative to be about corporate greed rather than Democratic spending policies from the 117th Congress was part of the reason she was able to win. And so I think you see Rosen sort of using that playbook, talking about cutting down the cost of housing through a few bills she has in the Senate and hoping that, you know, voters feel like she's working on those issues and not creating them.
And what is the sense? One of the other dynamics with this race is that President Biden is struggling in Nevada, mm-hmm. right? It appears, and looking back, that the cycles when Republicans have done well have been in midterm cycles and Democrats do well in presidential cycles. But that looks like it's a little bit different because Biden is struggling across the South and in the Sun Belt. So do you have your own diagnosis about why you think President Biden is struggling and potentially making things more difficult for Senator Rosen?
Yeah, I mean, I think Nevada, people think of it maybe as, oh, it's a blue state because it hasn't voted for a Republican in a presidential election since George W. Bush in 2004. But a lot of that more so has to do with just like the strength of the Reid machine, it's called there, the, you know, the party machine that Harry Reid built that outlives him. That's just really superior organizing on the ground, superior coalition building, everything that goes into, you know, the business of winning elections. But a lot of the indicators in Nevada are not necessarily trending Democrats' way. I think it's not this like demographic destiny narrative that people might have had. It's a majority minority state. There's a ton of Hispanic voters, but it's one of the most working class states in the country. It's one of the least college educated states in the country. the percentage of people who have a college degree is more in line with Kentucky, you know, or states like that that are deep red. And so in that sense, I think some of the just internal demographics don't bode super well for Democrats. And then also it's been the state that's been arguably most affected, I think, by some of the economic struggles out of COVID. It had the highest unemployment rate during COVID of any state because it's such an economy based on tourism and people feeling like they can both have the money and the public health clearance, right, to go to Vegas and gamble and do what you do there. And it still lags every state in unemployment. It's still at about 4 or 5%. So while the economic recovery has been really strong there, it hasn't been as strong as in some other places in the country.
And since you brought up the Reid machine, I am always kind of so curious. We're now almost, we're 2.5 years since Senator Reid passed away. Obviously, he was not as involved in the politics in kind of at the end of his life. He was busy talking to John Ralston about the book. What is your sense of how the Reid machine has kind of persisted? I mean, is it still as fearsome and dominant as it was when he was alive and around? Has it weakened? Has it gone through changes? I'm just curious, as we've seen the state become more open to voting Republican potentially, how much of that is about kind of Republican gains with non-college educated voters, with Hispanic voters, and how much of it is about the Democratic machine just not being as strong as it once was?
I mean, I think we saw some of the differences within the party he was able to paper over while he was alive sort of spilled out after he passed. You had Bernie Sanders aligned, more socialist Democrats overtake the state party in 2021. Immediately, all the people who were involved in the Reid machine pulled all the money out of the state party, made a shadow organization up in Washoe County where Reno is, and basically shadow ran the state, you know, had an outside state party that did a lot of the campaign work for the Cortez Masto campaign for the House races. And Democrats still won every race but the governor's race in 2022. So they won all the federal ones. They lost the governor's. They were the only state in the country that had a blue to red gubernatorial flip. So I think, you know, mixed results there, but they retook the state party over. I think they think that gives them a little more of an advantage this cycle, that it's easier to say when you're going up to voters, hey, I'm with the Nevada Democratic Party, than, hey, I'm with this like weird shadow organization called Nevada Democratic Victory. Like, do you want to volunteer with us? But I think that ground game is still really strong, especially in September. You'll have the Culinary Union, which is the big union of the hospitality workers. They're one of the most, I think, powerful political organizations in the country. They'll start knocking doors. They knocked a million doors in 2022. So that's a really powerful part of that sort of machine that Reid built. And you'll have just a lot of effort on the ground that, as of now, the Trump campaign really has very little presence on the ground in Nevada. And so I think it's a question of, can Democrats out-organize some of these Republican trends? Or will any of these trends in polling change? Because even the polling that we've had in Nevada is so disparate from one week to the next. You'll have Trump plus 12, and then you'll have it's even the next week. So it's hard to tell exactly what is going on.
And usually, I think the Nevada Independent has its own polling, right, to help us navigate what actually is going on there. You mentioned that Trump, the lack of a Trump ground game. From what you know, how different is that from 2020 and even 2016? I know that was almost ancient history, but was there a robust Trump campaign on the ground that you were aware of, or is this just kind of status quo for that?
Yeah, I mean, it predates my time covering the state, but from what I understand, in 2020, there was a pretty engaged team there. And in 2016, I've talked to some of the people who were involved in both of those efforts. Those were, you know, smart, seasoned operatives. And both times he came within 2 points. So, you know, he came closer than Romney or than McCain, certainly. And so I think they're definitely much slower to start than they were certainly in 2020.
And Nevada was a place in 2022 that we've talked about that did split its ticket, right? Voting for the Democratic senator for re-election and voting for a Republican for governor. How much of that do you think was intentional in the minds of voters? Like, oh, we need to split our ticket, or just sort of that's how it shook out. You had two competitive races. One ended up with a Democrat on top. One ended up with a Republican winning.
Yeah, I think it's a small enough state that people still feel connection sometimes to their elected officials. I think there's people who wanted a change at the governor's level who were upset about shutdowns and, you know, what Governor Sisolak at the time did with the gaming industry, the tourism industry, in the name of public health, right? That they didn't harbor that same, I think, resentment towards Senator Cortez Masto, who also has a very involved constituent services operation, who makes a point every year, sort of like Harry Reid did, to go to these rural counties and talk to ranchers and cattlemen and people who might not vote for her, but really know her out there. And I think also some of it was, and again, we're talking about, you know, 1-2% of people who split tickets, but some of it was a protest vote, I think, against Adam Laxalt, who has run multiple times in the state. He was the attorney general, but he ran for governor and lost previously. His grandfather was Paul Laxalt, was, you know, the first friend of Ronald Reagan and a former senator from Nevada. But Adam Laxalt grew up in the DC area, like me and Jacob. He, you know, sort of, I think there's a sense that he went back to Nevada to pursue this political career. And he didn't make much of an effort to reach out to independents. His strategy was that if we turn out the Republican base as much as possible, we can win. And as it turned out, there just wasn't perhaps enough of a Republican base. And after the Roe decision came out, and there was an audio recording of him saying that Roe was, it was something like the worst decided case in the history. Oh, he called Roe a joke. That's what it was. I think, you know, people cared about that. Nevada is a very libertarian state in a lot of ways. They're cool with abortion. They're cool with guns. I mean, you know, they're cool with easy marriage, easy divorce. That's kind of right. The whole Vegas thing. So people care a lot about abortion there. And that can make an impact to this cycle as well, because it's looking like there's going to be a ballot effort that's going to be successful to enshrine abortion rights in the state constitution, and that that'll be on the ballot this fall. And so Democrats, I think, are really looking at that as a way to juice turnout.
And do you have a sense of, between the two senators, two Democratic women, Jackie Rosen and Catherine Cortez Masto, who has the sort of larger profile? Because I feel like whoever is not up this cycle, Republicans will say, oh, well, you know, if Rosen's up, it's like, well, she's no Catherine Cortez Masto, or if Catherine Cortez Masto's up, well, she's no Jackie Rosen. Like, it just, they just switch depending on the, in comparing them. But who has sort of the bigger profile between the two of them?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, like, the polling last year, right, showed Cortez Masto with much higher name ID, but she just ran in this, like, really expensive race where everyone was seeing her ads constantly. So I think Rosen is, like, building that. Rosen was a political newcomer when she served one term in the House and then knocked off Dean Heller, the Republican at the time, for Senate. Cortez Masto was the attorney general. She was the chief of staff to the Democratic governor in the late 90s. She's been in the Nevada political scene for a really long time. But it's also a super transient state, right? So people come and go a ton. There's a ton of people moving in from California. And so every election cycle, even for the House members, but really for senators, you have to reintroduce yourself, because like a third of the electorate is not the people who were in the state last time you ran. So I think even regardless of like their individual reputations, every time a senator runs in Nevada, they're going to have to introduce themselves to the electorate. And it's no exception for Jackie Rosen.
So let's shift to the House to end our Nevada discussion. Republicans actually credit Democrats for a good gerrymander, meaning Democrats drew districts that put the three Democratic incumbents, Susie Lee, Dina Titus, and Stephen Horsford, probably out of reach under normal political conditions. But we may not be having an election under normal political conditions. Jacob, you've tweeted how Trump would probably need to win Nevada by 5 points in order to make these districts more competitive and reachable for Republicans. And now that doesn't seem as crazy as what it seemed at the beginning of this cycle. Gabby, for you to start this off, when you talk to these incumbents and you see them on the Hill, what is the sense? How worried are they about their reelection chances?
I think just the fact that these are competitive districts, they have like a latent sense of anxiety that they probably will every cycle. But I mean, just looking at the outside spending, looking at the candidates, I would expect they're less stressed than they were last cycle. In 2022, this was, I think, like some sort of point of personal pride for Kevin McCarthy. He really wanted to flip Susie Lee's seat, the third congressional district especially. So Congressional Leadership Fund, which is the House Republican-connected super PAC that does all the outside spending, they had, I think they spent the most money in any district in CD3 in Nevada. Las Vegas was the media market that they put the most money into in their initial spend. They were really, really focused on it. They really felt like this was the year to flip these seats and to test that gerrymander that Democrats were really worried about, especially Dina Titus, who had had a previously safe seat and now was having to really, you know, hold on for her life because to shore up the other two districts, they pulled some Democratic voters away from hers. So I think they were really freaked out last cycle, but they all won, and they won, I don't know about comfortably, but Susie Lee was the closest one, and she won by 4 points in I think you guys mentioned, a Biden plus seven district in 2020. And I think Republicans are looking at it this cycle, and they're saying, look, we feel like the House is going to come down to a handful of seats in California and New York. We have less money to spend than we did before. Why take another, you know, pull up the slot machine, to use a Vegas metaphor, when it didn't work in a cycle that it really should have worked for us last time. And so I think they're probably thinking, okay, if some of these polls are right and Trump is really going to win the state by, you know, 5, 7, 10 points, then that down ballot effect could pull our candidates over the top. But we're not going to put money in, at least right now. We don't feel confident enough in the candidates or in the terrain to make that investment like they did last cycle.
Yeah, I mean, Gabby, you mentioned, I think, in one of your recent stories that there's no money, right? CLF didn't put any money in their Zero. Initial reservation in the Vegas media market, which is just such a stunning turn. I almost wonder how much of it is that, like you said, for Kevin McCarthy being a point of pride, and obviously him coming from California, Central Valley, right across the border. Clearly, he kind of had a front row seat. Those California seats were very important to him, but Nevada was right next door, and Mike Johnson in Louisiana. I do wonder if there's even some sort of geographic element in addition to the political, that it's just less front of mind for the new head honchos in the House Republican Party, that they're not interested in contesting as seriously these seats right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think last cycle, right, you had three Democratic incumbents that for Lee and Horsford, they served two terms each in, you know, 2018 obviously was that blue wave year. 2020 was a presidential election year. Now that it's been three terms that they've all held these seats, including right in the red wave that wasn't, I think they're reevaluating. And also Vegas is an expensive media market, right? And it's a crowded one. Like we discussed, a competitive Senate race, competitive presidential race. You've got three congressional districts in one city. So you make a media buy for your candidate and like people are going to see it that aren't even in that district. It's hard to exactly target the message there. And so I think, you know, they're looking at the map and they're thinking we've got better opportunities to preserve or build the majority than Nevada.
And the recruitment has not been going great for the Republicans either. I mean, none of the three primaries seem to have kind of an A-list cast. Maybe I'm being a little unfair, but even compared to last cycle and in previous years, the Republicans who are in these races are people who have a losing track record, people who are untested, people who don't seem to be raising much money. Was there an effort to recruit kind of stronger candidates to run for Congress this time that was unsuccessful, or has that kind of apathy, did that apathy kind of affect who even got into these races to begin with?
I think it's interesting because you have a Republican governor now who's definitely trying to play more in these races and build out this Republican bench that the state party, which is, you know, not been a very effective tool for the Republicans nationwide, has not. But he's also really focused on making sure Democrats don't get a supermajority in the state legislature. So that's his primary focus. I think his secondary one is trying to get more Republicans federally elected. So initially in that CD3, Lee's district, they recruited a state assemblywoman, Heidi Kasama, who they were excited about. There's also, I think, a sense in Nevada that like women candidates are more serious. It's the state that has a majority female state legislature. So they were really excited about her. She ended up dropping out right after New Year's and flipping to go run in the state assembly again, because I think the Republicans, they were worried she was going to lose that assembly seat. And so then his team went in and their recruit that they have is this guy, Marty O'Donnell, who, if you're a gamer, which I'm not, so I didn't know, but I guess he's very famous in the gaming world for being the composer of Halo, like the music composer. So I think they're excited about him. I think national Republicans are sort of looking at that race and thinking, all right, you know, we'll see who, it's a crowded primary. There's like four candidates. They're like, we'll see who comes out of there. You also have the only guy who's won an election before, or there's two actually between the districts. One is John Lee in Horsford's district. He is the former mayor of North Las Vegas. He used to be a Democrat and he changed parties. And then Dan Schwartz in the third district, who was the state treasurer like a decade ago. So like you said, Jacob, there's a lot of unproven, untested candidates. They're really hoping that, like, there's a lot of self-funders. I think they're hoping that they can just sort of self-fund their way through the general and see what happens. But yeah, I think they were excited about Kasama, the assemblywoman that didn't pan out. And now I think a lot of national groups are waiting and seeing who's going to come through these primaries. But I don't get the sense that they think there's any superstars.
So we've spent almost this entire segment talking about how Republicans aren't going to win this, right? Their candidates are, you know, they're not investing the outside money right now. But the question in my mind is, how likely is it that if we have this conversation again in September, that we're talking about, oh, these three races are vulnerable, right? That they are, just in spite of all the things we mentioned, that these are going to be more competitive. We have them all rated right now as likely Democratic, which, for those of you that aren't familiar with our ratings, it's kind of barely on the House battleground. It's closer to safe than it is, or it's closer to solid than it is to toss up. But yet that Biden's performance at the top of the ticket, I just wonder if we're going to be, if we're going to be revisiting these districts here in a few months.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's all, how much do you trust these polls? Because the New York Times had Trump up 12 points. If that's the case, these Republicans are going to win these seats, right? I mean, to have a level of ticket splitting, 12-point ticket split, I haven't heard of something like that in Nevada. But if Trump is up to 12 points, it begs the question, why aren't outside groups investing in these House races? You'd think that they'd say, oh, well, this is the prime opportunity. So I think it speaks to some of the disconnect with the polling. Maybe there's internal polling showing something different. But I think it's going to depend how durable Trump's polling lead is over the summer and into the fall, and how much these operatives are trusting it and how much it squares with their own internal polling. But yeah, we could easily be back here in September and I could be saying, wow, Trump is still up enormously in these polls. People are really starting to get worried.
Yeah. Which doesn't mean what we're saying now is wrong. Right? This is the state of play, right? It is. But in the worst thing, you know, people can do whatever they want with our ratings, but ratings are not set in stone. The goal is not to have a rating 5 months from the election and never change it. Like, it will adjust. Like, if the atmosphere, the conditions change, then we'll change our rating.
As my boss would say, there's only one person who can tell you who's going to win. There's no poll, and it's him. So, and he'll tell you based on the early vote counts a few days before the election, he'll tell you.
Yeah. And for those of you who don't follow John Ralston on Twitter or X, you know, you definitely should. He's been covering Nevada for quite a while. So,
and I would be remiss to say, not to say, fellow Cornell Daily Sun alumnus.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Look at that.
There you go.
So I can claim him as well.
everywhere, taking over. Before we finish, I wanted to ask you, since you are the DC correspondent, when you need to talk to a Nevada member on Capitol Hill, who is the easiest person to find or get a hold of for a quote? And who is the most difficult person, the delegation to try to corner and get a quote from?
I almost have the same answer for both, which is Mark Amadei. So he's the one federally elected Republican in Nevada. When I find him, he's a yapper. He's so happy to talk about anything. He'll tell you his true thoughts. He's like, he's in a very safe district, and he's just like kind of has like a folksy charm. He speaks in a lot of like funny metaphors. So he can be hard to quote in print, but he's very open. Initially, during the speaker battle, when Mike Johnson was picked as the nominee, he voted present in conference. And I found him and he was like, oh yeah, I talked to his chief and I wanted to make sure he knew about my Nevada lands bills. Like, told me the whole story, had no problem doing that. But sometimes when he's upset about various things, he's pretty good at not being found, I would say. but then he'll usually give me a call, or if I reach out to him, he'll usually talk to me. So he's pretty good about that. As you would expect from someone who's in cycle in a competitive race, Senator Rosen can be a little difficult sometimes to find, and has really good media training. I'll say she sticks very on message. It's hard to sort of get her to just sort of loosey goosey chat the way some of the other ones will. But that's what happens when you're in cycle in a competitive race.
And I think Amede got himself in trouble, I remember, in 2019 during the first Trump impeachment, where a reporter found him and asked him what he thought about it. And he said, yeah, but you know, if the facts lead us to Trump committing a crime, yeah, I'll vote for impeachment.
Or yeah, that was my predecessor. And so, and it was a whole thing.
Yeah, I still remember that.
Yeah, if you get him talking, he'll tell you what he thinks. I mean, he's a pretty honest guy, so...
All right. Well, Gabby, hopefully you'll stick around for our final segment. But before we get there, if you are not reading Gabby's work and not reading the Nevada Independent, you definitely should. They're trying to do journalism in a different way, a not-for-profit entity. And so you should definitely support and read the Nevada Independent. But let's do our final segment. And finally, our last segment, Look What I Found, where we highlight something new that we've stumbled across. It usually is not politics. It's usually anything else, music, movies, food. Jacob, what did you find?
So some of you loyal listeners, readers of the Washington Post may remember that about a month or 2 months ago, I ended up at the center or adjacent to the center of a trivia cheating scandal at Red Bear Brewing, which is a brewery in Washington, D.C., in Noma. I was not the cheater, but I was the one who broke the story about there being this cheating, and it became this whole big thing. It was a big story. It died down. I stopped going to trivia because I had another commitment, but I went back one time in the last couple of weeks, and viewers can see the Red Bear plushie up on my bookshelf there, which is a sign of what I won as the champion at Red Bear a week and a half ago. So that is what I found. I found Ursula, the Red Bear plushie, after winning for the first time with my team the trivia at Red Bear. So it was a very nice full circle moment for me after the whole cheating thing went down a couple months ago to get that back there and finally clinch a championship.
Get those cheaters out of the way. And so are you now kind of a celebrity there? I mean, you won, your team won, but do people talk about the story, or is that just now it's ancient history?
I think people definitely talked about the story for like the first couple weeks after, like the week after the whole theme of the evening was like scandals. So all the questions were all the categories were scandal themed. The hosts really leaned into it. There was, because like the Washington Post reporter wanted to go like with my team to cover the story. I know NPR did a story about it where they recorded the whole evening. There was local news crews there. It was a really, for a couple weeks, it was like, I should invoice Red Bear for the publicity, but it was a big thing. I just don't know. I don't think it was ever like, because I don't know, my photo wasn't in it. Like, you know, I'm sure if I had mentioned it, people would be like, oh yeah, that makes sense. But no, I don't. I wasn't mobbed by the paparazzi when I walked in.
Were there any? Was there a question this week that you were like, all right, guys, I got this. Like, we're winning today.
Well, the final, so the way that it works is, and we did pretty well all five rounds, but the last question is one where you can wager however much you want, up to 50 points. But if you lose it, if you get it wrong, then you lose those points, which is the first, it's the only question where you can lose points on a wrong answer. And so the question that was the final Jeopardy, as it were, I keep on wanting to say that, they called Ursula's Revenge, was about Shakespeare. And it was what play by Shakespeare has main characters Prospero and Miranda? And as a kid who grew up in Shakespeare Club, performing in Shakespeare plays for many years of elementary school, I, of course, knew that this was The Tempest. And so we wagered the full wager. And I think that's what helped us clinch the victory. And so it was a high note to go out on.
That's huge. measure.
Nice. I was hoping that the host leaned in and one round was point to who you think is cheating right now. And like that would spice things up. And if people, I don't know, I feel like I'm plugging all sorts of things. If you haven't been to Red Bear, it's close to REI, which is in the formerly the U-Line Arena, which has a lot of history actually in DC, including, I believe it was the first, the location for the Beatles' first North American concert. Yeah. But now it's an REI flagship store. But all right, Gabby, we spent a lot of time on trivia. Gabby, what did you find?
I have been watching, I don't know if you guys watch Hacks, but the third season has been coming out in installments, 2 episodes a week, and the 7th and 8th episodes just aired. And I feel like the TV scape was just really missing like a smart comedy that's actually funny, because I feel like The Bear like keeps winning comedy awards and I'm like, it's anxiety inducing to watch The Bear. But Hacks is hilarious. It like, those jokes that like I get as like someone who's younger and on the internet, but like my mom watches it too and like she understands the comedy. I feel like it appeals. It's all about like multi-generational comedy and understandings of comedy, because it's Jean Smart being like an older comedian, and Hannah Enbinder, I think is how you pronounce her last name, who's like her younger writer. And it's just a great like buddy comedy dynamic. And if you haven't watched Hacks, I would definitely start from the beginning. It's not that hard to catch up and get on board.
Well, I admit I have no idea what you're talking about, but Jacob, are you in? Are you in on Hacks? It looks like you're
yeah,
in.
Yeah, I love the first two seasons. I have not. I can really only watch one show at a time, and I'm still finishing up another show. So I've been very, very interested in getting into the third season of Hacks, but I haven't started yet.
Great.
But I thought the first two were great. And I watched the first season with my parents because that was during COVID. And I think they really enjoyed it as well. And we found different things funny sometimes, but definitely a show, multi-generational, and a show with the big Nevada tie-in, right? Because the first season takes place all in Vegas.
Yeah. And there's a good political joke this season. Jean Smart, the main character, is gunning to be the new late night host. And her writer is like, why don't you just run for president? Seems like it'd be easier. And she's like, the house isn't big enough. She's like, I prefer bigger living area. So than the White House. But she said she'd love to get her hands on the Rose Garden. So
look at the synergy in this episode. See, I'm so old that I used to watch, I think the show was called Vegas. It had Tom Selleck and like a bunch of other people, but that was, I don't know, 15 years ago. So that's how behind I am. All right. So I found actually something that I've talked about before. I found that I still like to go to live shows. Last week I went to DC9 here in DC, saw a show. I went to see a band called Action Adventure. A couple other bands, Youth Fountain and Carpool, were playing, but it was a great show. The bands, you know, they had a genuine, at least portrayed a genuine appreciation for being there. They didn't, you know, some bands like to, you have to be a jerk or pretend like you're a rock star jerk, but they weren't like that at all. The crowd was everyone. No one was being a jerk. I escorted my teenage daughter to a show, and all it was me looking at the band through the back of someone's iPhone, right? Everyone just had their phone out. But this show, this was not. The crowd was a little bit older. People had phones and were taking pictures or video from time to time, but everyone was just having a good time. And so it was fun. So I found that if I ever have time again, maybe I should go, I should keep going back to shows.
Did anyone find you and recognize you and get a 6-month subscription to Inside Elections?
No, there was not a crossover. At least maybe they saw that I was having a great time. They didn't want to disturb me in my enjoyment of the bands, but we'll have to find another show. I'll put another half year subscription on the table, but no takers this time. Well, that's all the time we have. We talked about the runoffs in Texas. We also went deep into multiple races in Nevada with help from Gabby. Gabby, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. This was awesome.
At Inside Elections, we provide nonpartisan analysis of congressional, presidential, and gubernatorial races. With a combination of reporting and data, we break down the key races and bring valuable context to complex elections. Go to InsideElections.com to subscribe to the bi-weekly newsletter. We've got individual subscriptions and group packages that are tailored for association and corporate PACs. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the podcast and rate us on your favorite platform. If you're watching on YouTube, please click the thumbs up. Also subscribe. Do all the things that would be helpful. If you didn't like today's episode, please email Wayne Newton. We also want to thank our producers, Alan Tazinski and Melissa Lenner of Pretty Easy Podcasts, and our associate producer, Conrad Tolosa. Please come back and join us again next time.